So I'm Brian Franklin. As Ben said, I was in the last year demoted to elder at my church. I'm at New St. Peter's Presbyterian Church in Dallas. And by day, I'm a history professor at SMU, where I teach Texas history, among several things, American history and Texas history. And I served as a deacon at New St. Peter's for about 8 years. And just this last year, my congregation nominated and elected me to be an elder. And I'll tell you, for much of my life, that is actually what I felt my primary giftings were in. In fact, while I was in college even, I had planned to become a pastor. You know, I wanted to become a pastor. And so it was actually a real decision for me. And I might just share one personal story right off the bat to just illustrate to you, hopefully, how much I deeply love diaconal ministry and learning about diaconal ministry. About 6 years ago, my congregation actually nominated me at that time to consider being an elder. And I was excited about that, and I was like, yes, I'm going to do that. And I had been a deacon for about 4 years or so at that point. And so I went through our nomination process, a long training process, and we got to literally 2 weeks before installation and ordination. And so it would have been, you know, something like 8 months at that point of kind of the whole process. And we had some really hard things happen in my family, which involved just some very difficult things in my family I might share with you privately, that were such that I had to call my session and say, I can't care for my family and take on this elder role. And it was just really disappointing to me. I mean, it was really gutting, to be honest with you. And it wasn't but a few weeks into this. You know, a lot of times we have really hard things happen in our lives, and we don't ever really get to know why. Like, why did that happen? What was the point? Or sometimes we realize it, but it's many years down the road. And I told Ben, I think I was telling Ben this yesterday, that it wasn't but a couple weeks in where, for one of the, what I would say, the few times in my life, I really felt as if the Spirit was speaking to me, saying, one of the things I'm going to do with this time is I want you to still be a deacon. There are things I have for you to do as a deacon. And if you're an elder, you can't do those things. And I really leaned into that. And so I continued and even really upped, like reading a lot, studying a lot about the history of the diaconate and taking on the role of chairman on my diaconate and helping us think about what can we do here as deacons at our church and in our presbytery. And so I say all that to tell you I love diaconal ministry. I'm passionate about it. If I wasn't, I wouldn't be here from Dallas to get to share with you all. Not that Orlando doesn't have many great things to offer. I told my kids I was coming in there, are you going to Disney World without us? I said, no. It's just not my thing. So today, what I want to do here is really just a couple of things. I really want to make the case to you that the biblical office of deacon is a deep, broad, and expansive opportunity for mercy and service in your church community. And I want to try to at least begin to equip and inspire you to embrace this in your own church if you don't already. And I want to also say to you that I don't know who all here are deacons and who aren't, but this is not a word only for deacons. This is certainly a word toward the organized office of the deacon, but it is a word toward Christians for thinking about what does mercy ministry look like? What does small d diaconal ministry look like? And I think that for many of us, we've grown up in different traditions. I grew up Baptist. I've met a couple of folks here who grew up Catholic. Even people maybe who grew up in the PCA. Diaconal ministry has often been shrunk to, limited to, take care of the building, or just help do what the pastor needs done. And what I want to do with what we talk about from the Bible and what we talk about from history today, for those to not just be like information lessons to you, because I know for a lot of people, history is like, oh, great, I didn't come for a history professor. But the whole point of the history is to say, look at what deacons have done. Like, let this inspire you. Let this expand your category of what mercy can look like. I'll start. I think you might have this quote at the very beginning too, but I'll just read it with you here from John Lorimer, who's a Scottish pastor. And he said, in these circumstances, the friends of religion naturally turn to the scriptures. And he's talking about sort of difficult circumstances. They ask themselves whether the word of God throws any light on the treatment of poverty. And they find that Christians are not only called upon to feel for and relieve the indigent, but that express provision is made for this in the constitution of the Christian church. They find that there is a distinct order of office bearers, the deacon, divinely appointed to care for the poor. All right, so when we're in difficult circumstances, when people don't know what to do, what are we supposed to do? And Pastor Lorimer says, the Bible tells us what we're supposed to do. Deacon, that's what we're supposed to do. So I'm going to walk through just three things with you all today. One is, in Deacon 101, I call it a biblical, historical, and practical guide to diaconal ministry at your church. So I want to talk a little bit about the biblical foundations for diaconal work, the historical foundations, and then just share a few practical things with you. And we can even use that time to, I can show you some of the documents I've provided you. And I really would love to have plenty of time to just share Q&A. What do you do? What at your church? What do I do at our church? So let's start with the Bible. All right, so in the Old Testament, and you're thinking, why are we going to the Old Testament? Deacons aren't there. What's that? I'll just use my phone. Thank you so much, though. There are a few foundational concepts in the Old Testament that really lay the groundwork for what diaconal ministry is. Okay, and the first is this concept of the poor in the Bible, the poor. Now, when we often think about the poor, we're thinking primarily of the poor monetary, right? Like people who don't have money. In the Old Testament, it would particularly have been people who don't have property, but certainly money as well. That is true. That's a foundational, critical, important way to understand who the poor are. People who don't have money to buy things, people who don't have things that, assets, right, that they can sell or that they can depend on in a hard time. But the Pentateuch actually has a lot more to say about who the poor are in the scheme of Israel, right? This first is, of course, people who don't have money, but the second, there's really four groups in the Old Testament that are considered in the class of poor. Without money. Second, the widow and the orphan. Now, this is a concept that the New Testament brings over directly, the widow and the orphan. Why are the widow and the orphan poor by being widows and orphans? Yeah?
They don't have access in society. They don't have standing in the way that men did, and especially owning property and that kind of burden in society.
Yeah, there was a lot of dependence upon a male or a patron or a patriarchal setup to actually have access to society, to be able to have standing, to be able to have protection in society. And that goes for both the widow and the orphan, because they're both without the person who's supposed to be immediately above them, caring for them. Right? They are without that kind of protection. And it actually doesn't matter, if you look closely in the Old Testament or in the New, it doesn't matter whether that widow or orphan has money or not. It doesn't have a word to say about whether that's a widow who has a bunch of cash, right, or an orphan who has a big inheritance. They're considered among the poor if they're an orphan or they're a widow. And any of you, maybe you have personally, but any of you have seen, I'm sure, people in your churches who have been widowed or have been orphaned, and there's a poverty there, a real loss that can't be covered with money, right? And it needs to be covered with mercy. The third group are the stranger and the sojourner. Stranger and the sojourner. I could pick one of a million verses out of the Old Testament to talk about what God calls Israel to do in caring for the stranger, the sojourner, or the alien, as sometimes called, right? Those without money, the widow and the orphan, the stranger, the sojourner. Why is a stranger or a sojourner poor, regardless of whether they have money or not?
They're outside of the covenant.
Yeah, so in practical terms, in the Old Testament, they're outside. They're not immediately in the covenant. They're outside of it. They literally don't know people. They don't have family, probably. I don't know if any of you, if you've ever traveled overseas, especially somewhere where English isn't the first language, it's very disorienting. Even if you're somewhere that's sort of relatively friendly to, like, in France or something, right? Like, I don't know how friendly the French always are, but, like, but, you know, even when you go somewhere like that, it can be very disorienting to even just make your way around, much less figure out how you're supposed to, I don't know, pay taxes or how you're supposed to do anything in life. That's why the stranger or the sojourner is poor as well, because they are disoriented and sort of outside of whatever that society is. They're poor, they need mercy. And the last group, surprisingly, that is considered among the poor, or that those that need care in the Old Testament, are the Levites. Why is that? The Levites are not given property like everyone else. They do not have an inheritance in the land. They have been set aside for service to the Lord. But in doing so, while that is an honor, they're also in a position of total dependency on the other people of Israel to care for them, right? By position, by their in name, right? By their tribe, they do not have property. So there's a broad category for the poor in the Old Testament, and it's not just people who don't have money. It's really less about whether people have money and more about what kind of standing, access, ability do they have to function in their society. And if we think about poverty that way, it expands our view of who is it that we are called on to help. Another category that's really important for mercy in the Old Testament is justice. Justice. That doing mercy is doing justice. Just read a couple of passages here for you out of Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy chapter 10. I'm going to read about 10 verses here. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord which I am commanding you today for your good. Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth with all that is in it. Yet the Lord set his heart in love on your fathers and chose their offspring after them, you above all peoples as you are this day. Circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart, and be no longer stubborn. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve him and hold fast to him, and by his name you shall swear. He is your praise, he is your God, who has done for you these great and terrifying things that your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. So this whole passage calls the people of Israel to remember, to praise God, to remember what God has done for them and caring for them when they were needy and sojourners and undeserving. And there's one response that they're supposed to do now for that. And that is what? Do that for others. You were needy, I cared for you. You were a sojourner, I welcomed you. Go and do likewise. One more passage out of Deuteronomy chapter 24, looking at verse just 17 and 18. You shall not pervert the justice due to the sojourner or to the fatherless, or take a widow's garment and pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore I command you to do this. Do not pervert justice for the fatherless, for the widow, for the sojourner. And justice here, and we can see, is does not just have in mind the pure legal definition, right? Someone committed a crime, they are held accountable for it. It says, for example, don't take a widow's garment and pledge. There's nothing wrong with giving a pledge, right? If you need help with something and you say, okay, I'm going to pledge, I'm going to give you my watch, and you hold on to it until I've made it right. This is telling them, hey, even if you're doing something for the widow and normally someone would give you a pledge, you know, their garment, hold on to this until we've completed this. He says, don't do that. That's actually unjust to take a pledge from the needy person over whom you have power to take the pledge. Don't take the pledge. Now, this is a principle. Obviously, this is not, I'm not telling you to like base your banking business on this necessarily. But I would say you might think about basing your banking business on this. And that what justice means can differ according to the level of poverty and need of the person that you're actually giving to. That's what the Bible's telling us here. It says poor, In the Old Testament, there's a broad conception of justice, which is not just about truth and consequences, but about broad, capital J justice, capital K, capital F, fairness. I don't know where that K came from. Finally, there's this issue of mercy in the Old Testament. So the poor, what is justice and what is mercy, which kind of encapsulates all this. I want to read just a few verses out of Deuteronomy chapter 15. I'm going to read verses 7 through 11. If among you one of your brothers should become poor, in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, oh, the seventh year, the year of release is near. And your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother, and you give him nothing. And he cried to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. For there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. This is a really powerful passage because it almost anticipates, it's kind of like what the pastor said last night, it almost anticipates our objection, right? That, oh, a needy person comes to you and you might object and say, well, they're going to get paid like next week. You know, or in this case, it's like, oh, the year of Jubilee essentially is coming. They'll be fine. It says, the second you say, they'll figure it out or something else will take care of it, you have done an injustice to them. And then this ends with a passage that Jesus quotes. You will always have the poor with you. Now, I don't know about you, but I've heard that verse many times growing. Like, I thought that verse literally meant, well, what are we going to do? You know, like, we can't take care of all the problems because we're always going to have the poor with us. Isn't that kind of how culturally we sort of think about this? This says the opposite. This says, there will never cease to be poor in this land. Therefore, I command you, open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. You will always have the poor with you. Therefore, you always have time and ability to give. Not, you will always have the poor with you, so I can limit what I give. No, you will always have the poor, so keep giving. You'll never have an opportunity where you can't give anymore because there will always be people who need. And again, Old Testament, the need is not just money, right? You may not have money to give, like you personally may not have money to give right now, but you might have an hour to give to that kid whose dad left the family, right? You might have advice to give to that woman who's been widowed and doesn't know how to handle her finances. Like, there are things you can give. What about the New Testament? What does the New Testament say about broad diaconal ministry? I love to start in Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4, where after Jesus' temptation, he comes to the synagogue and he opens the scroll of the prophet Isaiah and he unrolled it and he reads this. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And then he closes the scroll and he says, today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. So he reads the scroll, which says, this is what the Lord's work is about. This is what we're about. The Messiah is going to be about proclaiming good news, proclaiming liberty to captives, recovering of sight to the blind, liberty to the oppressed, the year of the Lord's favor. And he says, it's me, and this is what I'm about. All of these things. A broad scope of what mercy is. And what's really powerful, too, about what Jesus is doing is he's actually not, at its heart, doing a totally new thing. Now, Jesus is going to usher in a new covenant, right, by his blood. But the work he's doing is the same work that God's always been doing. The work he describes himself doing is the work that Isaiah said they'd be doing. The work he's describing he's doing is what Deuteronomy said should the people of Israel should be doing. And of course, Jesus describes his own work as Messiah as being a servant, as being a giver, as being a deacon. And perhaps if you are a deacon or you've done this kind of study, probably the most important place you go to for, well, where's the office of the deacon, is actually in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 6. And if you'll remember, what happened is the apostles in Acts chapter 6, they're preaching, the church is growing, and a complaint rises by the Hellenists, so the Greeks, that the Greek widows are being overlooked in the daily distribution. And the apostles say, look, we can't take care of all this. We can't do all the preaching, all the teaching, all the shepherding, and take care of all these things. We need to establish someone who can focus on this, an office. And so, seven men are sort of brought up from the people, appointed, and these are the first deacons. And I want to stop for a second here to look at this passage, because, again, even in this passage, we often are tempted to get the sense that, well, deacons serve tables, right? Deacons serve tables, because the apostles say, well, we're not here to serve tables. But serving tables is, I forget the literary word, but it's like a metaphor. It's a small thing that's meant to apply to many things. It's not just a literally serve tables. So let's just, I'm going to read to you just the verse, few verses of Acts chapter 6. Now in these days, when the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint by the Hellenists arose against the Hebrews, because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. And the 12 summoned the full number of the disciples and said, it is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brothers, pick out from among you seven men of good repute, full of the Spirit and wisdom, whom we will appoint to this duty. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and the ministry of the word. And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and they, the gathering, chose Stephen, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Prochorus, and Nicanor, and Timon, and Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte of Antioch. These they set before the apostles, and they prayed and laid their hands on them. The focus here in the passage, the occasion for why deacons are appointed, is more than just serving tables, literally serving tables. It's focused on meeting the needs of the needy among you. Right? So deacons do meet needs. In this case, what were they? Whose needs were they meeting?
Widows.
Widows.
Elements.
Yeah, particularly the Greek widows, but also, you know, kind of the church's needs broadly, because they were of the church, right? So they do meet needs. But deacons also lead in service, right? They're serving tables. They're doing the thing that may or may not get noticed, but is necessary for the spiritual and practical care of the church. Here's another thing. Deacons do justice. Deacons do justice. Okay, the Greek widows were being neglected. Now, it's actually unclear in this passage, and I've tried to read a lot about it. It's unclear in this passage whether we don't know why they were being neglected. It is possible they were being neglected because they were Greek. And there was some kind of ethnocentrism going on in the church, and they were being neglected for that. It's also possible that they were being neglected as an unintended consequence of the way they had organized the system, right? That a system was set in place, and however things worked out, they were being left out. Either way, they were being neglected. And either way, it was an injustice. Right? And this is, I think, important for us in our society, because we talk a lot today, you hear a lot about systemic injustice or systemic racism. And, you know, that sometimes can get us very defensive, because you don't want, I mean, you might be saying, I'm not trying to be racist, or I'm not trying to be unjust. And that might be very true. Your church may not have anyone in it who says, I don't like people like that. But it can at the same time be true that you have ways of doing things at your church or at your organization that, unbeknownst to you, discriminate against groups of people because they don't have familiarity with the way things are done, for example. And so either way, we find ourselves in situations where someone is experiencing injustice, and it is the deacon's job to make sure that justice is done in those places. Deacons meet needs, deacons serve, deacons do justice, and finally, deacons proclaim the gospel. They chose seven men, and how did they choose those men? What did they recognize in those men? full of the Spirit and of wisdom. Interestingly, the apostles say, we can't do all this and serve tables. You might expect the next verse to go like, well, who's been serving tables? Who can serve tables well? No. Who is full of wisdom and of the Spirit? Let's get them to do that work. And then we see the work that flows out of that, because what happens immediately after this? Stephen, the guy just appointed the deacon, preaches one of the great sermons of all time as he's being killed, right? So he is an evangelist. The deacon is an evangelist, right? And then, right after that, we get the story in Acts chapter 8 of Philip, a deacon, who is on the road, and what does he do? He preaches the gospel, and he baptizes someone. It might be one of my differences with the BCO, I'm just saying. either way, regardless of the sacrament here, what we see is that deacons proclaim the gospel. You're not just doing practical work. You're doing spiritual work and speaking spiritual words. And that is just confirmed when we go to 1 Timothy 3 when it says, we want to appoint deacons at the churches. This is the kind of people we want to appoint. And how many things in that passage, if you remember, have to do with how well you can build stuff or fix lights or mow grass or something like that? None of them. All of the characteristics are character characteristics. All of them. Right? So, the job of deacon then is to minister mercy, minister justice, proclaim the gospel, meet needs, and you are equipped to do that not because you're handy. I would never have become a deacon if that was the case. that's my wife. She's the one with the handles the tools and stuff. And no, it's character. That's what drives, right? From the compassion that came from the Samaritan is what put his hands to work. And that work then is for the building up of the kingdom. Okay, so there's a broad biblical overview of diaconal work. So just from that alone, I hope if these are things you haven't quite thought of in the same way before or you hadn't heard ever before, I hope that will inspire you just from the Bible that when we say deacon, we're not talking just about care for your building, which, by the way, in the PCA is one of your responsibilities. But that's just like the smallest beginning baseline sliver. Actually, what you're being unleashed to do is show mercy and justice to the people who you have care for, which includes your church and the people you come into contact with. Now, let's talk a little history, because I'm a history professor and this is what I do. History. And again, I want to share these things with you, not so that you might remember as little factoids, although, you know, you'd make me really happy if you did, but to give you examples throughout church history of what I just told you is in the Bible, to what deacons are supposed to do. That this isn't just my interpretation. I think the Bible teaches this, but I want to show you that throughout church history, deacons have done a lot. And then what I told you at the beginning, that I want you to think of the role of deacon, the office of deacon, as an expansive one, not a limited one, which is often the case in our circles. We kind of have like, hey, elders do that. Deacons do this, you know. I'm not trying to say deacons can do everything elders can do or vice versa. But what I am saying is that think broadly and expansively about what the opportunities are for deacon. So we'll just do kind of a few sections here. First, in the early church. One of the first things that the church is known for is its care for the poor and the needy. Right? Many of you have probably heard these stories about how they're a witness to the Roman people because they're taking in orphans that have been abandoned. And they're a witness to the Romans around them because they're caring for widows among them. They're a witness to the people around them because those who do have material wealth are coming and they're laying it at the feet of the apostles and saying, do mercy with this. Right? That's diaconal ministry. That's what they're doing. And one of the things that the church and the Roman Empire does early on is establish what they called at the time, we translate hospitals, but really they were broader than just medical care. They were more like a hostel, if you've ever stayed at a hostel. They're actually more like what we heard in the story of the Good Samaritan, an inn where someone's basic needs can be provided for, and oftentimes that meant medical needs as well. Christians were doing that. They were opening their own homes or, in the first few centuries of the church, beginning to establish separate buildings where the whole purpose of it was to care for someone who was in need, a stranger along the way. A person who had fallen hard on hard times and couldn't take care of themselves. We'll take care of you here. This develops into what we kind of now think of as modern hospitals, which often, by the way, have saints' names on them and are attached to Christian denominations. This comes all the way back from like the 2nd and 3rd centuries of the church. Easily, as far as I know, the most powerful voice for the poor and for diaconal ministry in the early church, first few centuries of the church, was John Chrysostom. You might have heard of his name before, John Chrysostom. He was based in Antioch, just sort of like a major hub of the early ancient world, you know, in Orlando or a Dallas or a New York or something like that. A city of wealth, a city of trade, people coming through, and also a city with great, great poverty. And his deep desire was to see the church be so known in Antioch for caring for the poor that what he said was he wanted Antioch then to be known as what he called a harbor for the poor. Right? A harbor is that when the seas are crashing, a ship can pull into a harbor and be like, I'm safe here. I'm going to be cared for here. John Chrysostom preached so passionately that the church would be so known for its care for the poor, for its mercy that it showed to the needy, that anyone in the world would know Antioch, the city, as a harbor for the poor. And you can easily find this. He preached a whole series of sermons on caring for the poor, on mercy, on the topic of alms, right, almsgiving. And I'd love to talk with you all about some of this as well. One of the things I've loved about my church, where I've been for about 13 years now, is it has a history from its very beginning of alms. And what this is the collection of money, materials, specifically for the poor and the needy. It's a category at our church. It's a whole separate fund from the general fund of the church. And it's given for the purpose of showing mercy to the poor. This comes from the early church. John Chrysostom preached powerfully and very convictingly to his people. I mean, he'd get up in the pulpit and be like, there were people on the way here from when you walked from your house to this church that you passed by, and that is not something that we do as Christians. It's like, oh, because we probably all did that. So, early church, John Chrysostom, the establishment of hostels, hospitals, and alms. In the medieval era, I don't want to downplay, I don't want to be the guy who says that, like, the medieval Catholic Church ruined everything. That's not what my point is here. But what I will say is that as Protestants, which I presume all of us in this room probably are, there were a lot of things, there are a lot of reasons the Protestant Reformation happened. Right, of course, the righteous shall live by faith, theological reasons, but actually really fascinatingly and powerfully, one of the things that the Protestant Reformation recovered was mercy and care for the poor and the vital importance of the office of deacon. During the medieval era, I was just talking to a brother who's at one of the tables downstairs. He's at RTS Orlando now. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name. But he grew up Catholic. I told him I was doing this, and he was like, okay, what are deacons then in the PCA? Because when I grew up, like, deacons basically had to train with the Catholic Church for like 6 or 7 years so that they could become assistants to the priests. That's a medieval leftover of what the deacons became in the medieval Catholic Church. They became assistants to the priests. What does the priest need? Do that. Serve the priest. Also in the medieval era, alms for the poor, the collection of alms to be able to give to the poor, shifted theologically as well. And it became giving of alms for merit. The giving of alms for the earning of merit before God. And if you remember from your Reformation history, if you've ever done this, one of the things that Luther railed against was this idea that you could give alms, give money, so that it could then go to be able to build St. Peter's, the Vatican. And by doing so, you might get someone a few years out of purgatory, or you might buy some kind of relief from your sins in the now or later. Alms for merit. And so what you had in that era is you had the birth of a bunch of sort of orders who ended up doing a lot of this work. You think of like the Franciscans, for example, who were known for their taking vows of poverty and caring for the poor. One of, not the only reason, but one of the reasons many of these monastic orders began and did the work they were doing is because the institutional church wasn't doing it anymore. Well, this is recovered in the Protestant Reformation. I'll talk today just a bit about Martin Luther and especially about John Calvin. that this idea of caring for the poor and having an office that is dedicated to that from the scriptures was vitally important for them. Okay? So, Martin Luther in modern-day Germany really helped pioneer what it meant for the church to collect alms and to care for the poor. So in Wittenberg, where he was, he worked actually with the town council. So this was like a private-public partnership. And they created something called the Common Purse. This is, and it functioned as basically a religious social welfare ordinance. The church would collect gifts, and it would be distributed to the poor. It literally, they called it the common chest. They would literally in a town have a literal chest. And in Wittenberg, for example, it had four locks on it, and four different guys held the locks. Right? So there was this sense of like, we're going to care for the poor, and we're going to use this, but we're going to have accountability. So these stewards would have access to it, but they had to do it together. Let me just read to you a few of the things that with this money, with the common chest, that the church did when they said, we mean to care, show mercy and care for the poor. This is a few things that they did in Wittenberg. Obviously, people who are money poor, care for orphans, care for women who have been widowed. But here's some more interesting ones. Interest-free loans to artisans. Repayment if possible. Providing dowries for women getting married. The refinancing of high-interest loans. Educational or vocational children, or training for children. At one point, they added a doctor to essentially the payroll who was paid out of the common chest so that he could be free to just take care of anyone who was sick. He's paid out of the common. It's actually kind of similar to what you're doing as an administrative deacon, except with a medical degree. Don't do that. No surgery, Ben.
Quiet, John.
Really creative. And think about, what do these things have in common? Because they're not all about, oh, someone who doesn't have any cash. They're about freeing people. They're about providing some measure of uplift or justice to someone who doesn't have access to it. I think especially, we're talking at our church about this issue right now, the refinancing of high-interest loans. Mm-hmm. How many of you have either poor people who come into your house or your church, or students who come in and they're saddled with debt? And it is such a burden. Any of you have ever had that kind of debt? I know I have. It's such a burden. And it's not just a financial burden. It becomes a spiritual burden. The freedom that comes with a low interest or no interest loan. And imagine if the church could do that. It's really powerful. John Calvin in Geneva. I'll have you know, when we think of John Calvin, when much of the world thinks of John Calvin, we think of predestination. We think of the Institutes of the Christian Religion and these high theology. And that's all true. I don't want you to not think that. But I deeply believe that Calvin should be just as well known for just how much he wrote about, cared about, and did to care for the poor and the needy. It was deeply important to him. By the way, the person he read the most and got all of his ideas from was John Chrysostom. He talks about this. He was a leader in caring for the poor. The most important reformer by far on the subject, both in caring for the poor and on elevating the office of the diaconate to something that is valuable, that is God-given, Bible-given. It would not be, in Calvin's Geneva, junior elder, right? So that do this job for a little while, and then maybe if you do really well, you can become an elder. It was an office of its own. It had its own training with its own purpose. This is one of the things he says in the Institutes. The faithful and honest stewards of God are those who share with their brethren the riches entrusted to themselves, for nothing brings men nearer to God than beneficence. Right? So he is saying here, one of the things that can bring one closer to God is the giving. Right? And this is an echo of what we read in Deuteronomy. Right? I loved you and I cared for you, so go do this for others. We're actually being the most sort of full sense of an image bearer we can be. When we do as God, we are as God is in some ways, in small ways, and we do as God does, gives. Let me talk about deacons in Geneva. So in Geneva, they actually had a three-part role of the diaconate. I'll be very careful in how I say this because people have very different views on this. I'm just going to tell you what they did in Geneva, okay? The diaconate administered charity. They collected and distributed alms. They cared for the poor. And they actually had three types of deacons in Geneva. So, the first were ordained male deacons, whose primary jobs and gifting were to manage and administrate the work of the diaconate. Right, so make sure the money's taken care of. Make sure it's being organized well, reported well. Some of you may, you know, come from that kind of background where you're like, I'm not very good with hands-on things. I'm not even great like person to person, but I'm a very good administrator. That's the kind of person who would have been in this role. The second, they also had ordained male deacons who did most of the practical service, the ones who actually took the money out and distributed or took the provisions out and cared for the poor. And then they had a third office of appointed, office-holding, non-ordained deacons who were men and women. And they were appointed also to then focus on direct ministry to the poor. Now, in BCO language, we would call these people assistants to the deacons. But in Geneva, they just called them deacons and deaconesses. But again, the three part here was the idea of doing care for the poor well, and doing it in a way that maximized the giftings of the people who are participating in it. Are you an administrator? You're going to be an administrative deacon. Are you a server, the person who really likes, you know, getting the hands dirty, caring for the people hand to hand? Then you're going to be the serving side deacon. Now, both participated in the office, but they had different focuses. And then also, we're going to appoint people, not ordain, but appoint people who are men and women who can help us in this work. Because we need more of the hands-on people. They collected alms regularly. John Calvin said that there are four absolute critical elements to a worship service. Word, sacrament, prayer, alms. Most of our churches think you hear word, prayer, sacrament, right? And in word, he included singing. Word, prayer, sacrament, alms. Necessary elements of a church service. They would collect at every service. They would pass a basket around. They tried all kinds of different things. Anyone who's been a deacon, you'll resonate with this. They're like, we got to try different ways. We pass something around. They put a basket on a pole, you know, and reach it out. At one point, they like put people at the door, you know, so it's like you're going to have to pass by us and not put something in the basket. They tried all kinds of things, but it was a critical point of the service. And he saw, by the way, alms as the natural outworking of the Lord's Supper. So you would receive the Lord's Supper, in which we get the greatest picture of God's gift to us. And the natural outworking of that was then to give. To alms. They established a particular fund in Geneva called the French Fund. Now, during the era that John Calvin was there, John Calvin himself was a Frenchman and was a refugee. And there were French refugees, especially French refugees, pouring through Geneva, Switzerland, all the time because of the persecution of the Protestant church at the time. Geneva, this is not an exaggeration, this is not an anachronism where I'm taking a present concept and just putting it on the past. It was a refugee city. The city of Geneva was, many people at the time thought of it and wrote about it as overrun by refugees, overrun by immigrants, because so many people were moving in because of persecution, because of fear. And some of the wealthier French who were refugees or immigrants themselves worked then with the church in Geneva to create the French Fund. And it was there as an alms fund. And at base level, it was there to meet basic needs. Because you imagine a city that's filled with people who have just brought maybe nothing but the clothes on their back. So to provide food, shelter, basic care for people. But they also then used it strategically. Again, this is an alms fund administered by the deacons in Geneva. They used it strategically for the kingdom. So beyond basic poverty relief, they trained pastors. They funded seminary education for people who would then go out all over Europe. Right? So this is, for example, one of the ways that Calvinism gets to Scotland. This is why we have Presbyterians, is what I'm trying to say. It's one of the reasons. They paid for printing. They printed Calvin sermons, they printed hymns, and sent those out all over the place. They paid for people who went on missionary journeys all across Europe to share the gospel. Calvin called alms, this is probably my favorite phrase when it comes to how we think about alms. He called alms seed to be sown. Seed to be sown. this has been really revolutionary for our diaconate, and I want you to think about this concept of seed to be sown. It is tempting for us, I think especially as Americans, maybe many of us are or have come from basically middle-class type society, to think of money and savings as something that you conserve and that you're very careful with so that it doesn't go away, right, for one way or another. The alms fund is not that. An alms fund is not for conserving and holding back to be safe with. It is seed to be sown. What good is seed held back in a box or a bag? It's no good. It's likely to die. It is to be sown. Now, as in the parable of the sower, some of that seed is not going to grow up into what you want it to grow up into. Some of it's going to fall on rocky ground, and it's going to be, monetarily, feel like a waste or a mistake. But it is still seed to be sown. What it says the strongest parallel to in the parables is actually the parable of the talents. Right? The master gives three different servants different amounts of money. I can't remember the exact. It's like 10, 5, and 2, or 10, 5, and 1. And he comes back. He goes away, and he comes back, and one is sowed, and he says, you know, great job. You've done well with this. The second one, you've sowed it, and it's gained. Good job. And then the one says, I was afraid. I didn't want to lose it. It seems like he's being responsible, right? I didn't want to lose it. I didn't want to invest it. And then the market crashes and I lose it. And he said, Jesus, or the parable, the master says, you've wasted this. This is wicked, right? I gave it to you to invest. That's what alms is, seed to be sown. Final section of history. I briefly read to you from John Lorimer of Scotland. He wrote this whole book called The Deaconship. And again, just some ideas of what they did in, I can't remember where he was in, I think it might have been in Dundee, in Scotland. Here's some of the things that he encouraged his deacons to do. Knocking on doors, visiting families in the neighborhood, spending time in the schools. They would go around and, with the permission and cooperation of people, would collect and deposit funds on behalf of the families in the neighborhood into the bank. To sort of help them manage money and learn how to make money in the market. And then interestingly too, he says one really valuable thing, which we're doing right here, is you should go learn from other deacons. So at the end of the book, there's like a multi-page Q&A with a deacon from another city, and it's like, what did you do? Let me jump forward a bit. In very recent history to the PCA's Book of Church Order. Two things out of that, if you haven't read it recently, that deacons have or are called to. In chapter 3 of the BCO, it says that officers, including the deacons, have ecclesiastical spiritual power. They are given by their congregation and ordained by God to have church and spiritual power, and then that they are to administer this. How? Not through a heavy hand, not with arrogance, but through, quote, visiting the sick and comforting the afflicted. And then at the end it says, and sometimes essentially through church courts. It describes the office of deacon as an ordained office by God, and what you're supposed, and the way you administer that spiritual power is through caring for the sick and comforting the afflicted, and sometimes through the church courts, right? So there's a value here, even in our own denomination, of what the office is for. And then my favorite phrase, I mean, there aren't a lot of lovely phrases in the BCO. Sorry for all you BCO nerds out there. But in chapter 9, which talks about the deacons, it says one of the jobs of the deacons is to develop the, do y'all know this? The grace of liberality. Favorite phrase in the BCO. Develop the grace of liberality. What does that mean practically? I forget who I was talking to earlier, but it was you. It's not the job of deacons to do all the stuff. It's the job of the deacons to develop that grace, that free giving, liberal, small l, liberal free giving grace in the people so that we all do it. Right? You are going to burn out if you do it all. Historically, it's true. You know it in your own life. But you will be enlivened if you develop that grace in the other people in your church. So, finally, just a few practical tips to you, for you, and then I'd love to maybe look at this packet with you. If you have any questions, we can talk. A few practical tips for you when you're thinking about, well, what do I do to expand our diaconate, to think more broadly about what our diaconate might do? And by the way, I don't mean expand, so now do all the things. I mean expand, broaden your mind about what is possible. And then, we were talking about this last night, you can't do everything. You're going to have to make some decisions, but make those decisions with a broader scope in mind. So the first thing you can do, here's my history professor coming out, is you can read. Like any topic or task, you may not be much of a reader, but there is so much out there to read and learn from, including from people within our own circles who have written about this. You'll get to hear Chris Six today. He's got a tiny little book that's so helpful. This tangible book, really great. Tim Keller wrote about this, especially early in his ministry, a lot. And then, of course, you can go read Calvin. You can go read Chrysostom. They write about this stuff. And what you find in all this writing is that diaconate work is broader than table service. The second thing I want to encourage you to do practically is let your imagination go. Like, start thinking broadly. Like, be creative. Like, what are the needs around here? And I'm not limiting those needs to what can money solve, right? Like, what's the need in my neighborhood? Like, God, this section of the city is always so dirty. Could we do something about that? Or, man, there are a lot of kids who clearly in this apartment complex need after-school programming. That's a need, right? That's a poverty. Let's think about where we could do something about that. And again, church history attests to this. It's that diaconal work encompasses all sorts of things. Is there a need? Deacons get to work, right? Like, it's not, is the need money? Solve that. Or is the need, you know, set up the communion tables? Like, it's broad. And then the third thing is to organize. I was talking to Robert about this last night, that one of the ways that deacons can get overrun and overburdened is that you don't have organization and structure. Like, this is how we do it. Or when a need comes to us, we have a process for how we think through it and do it. Or when we have a project we're doing, here's our structure, who does what. That can seem cold, it can seem calculating, it can seem very, you know, like, the worst of stereotypical Presbyterian, but it's actually freeing to think about organization and structure within your church, within your diaconate. Think carefully about what are our goals, what will be our processes, who's gifted in which specific way, and let's organize according to that so that we can be free to do this work. That's all I've got in terms of teaching today. If I might show you just really quickly, and I'm not going to teach through this, but I just want to show you a little bit about what I provided to you. So you had the outline here. I gave you a bunch of possibilities for reading. The bulk of this packet is a handbook that our diaconate has crafted, and it's sort of very BCO-ish, you know. But what it does, what it did for us, is help us put into words, this is how we organize ourselves. This is how we do what we do. It's been very helpful for us. One of the most important things for that that I mentioned that I'll just mention to you is our alms ministry. It's on pages 10 and 11, 10, 11, 12 of this packet. I should say at the end of this packet, I've put our deacon training syllabus. So the first... After I became an elder last year, my first task was to train the new incoming class of deacons that we were nominating, which I volunteered for, by the way. It's excited to do. So we've created a syllabus of how we did our deacon training. Happy to talk to you more about that. If I get to share practically about our alms ministry as a practical encouragement that I think every single church could do. And this came from the very beginning of our church 24 or so years ago before I was there. Fourth Sunday of every month, we collect alms. And a deacon comes up to the pulpit. And again, we even have some basic language here of how we do it. But we just essentially do a couple of things. We usually share just a short passage of scripture that has to do with care, mercy, the poor, generosity, whatever that is. We say, in general terms, in the last month, here's what we were able to do with the alms funds that you, the congregation, gave. And we don't name names, but we'll say, we cared for a congregation member who had medical bills, or we cared for a neighbor who needed help paying rent, or we sent some of the funds to M&A Disaster Response to help with this. And this month we're collecting again. And we just offer an encouragement that, hey, this money is for those who are in need. If you have a need, come to the deacons. We want to talk to you. We want to care for you. That's what we do. We do it fourth Sunday every single month. And then there's a separate bowl for collecting alms from the normal tithes and offerings. And that rhythm has been so powerful in our church for a long time, so that it's just part of our lifeblood, that like we have this ministry, we do this ministry, and we know that if we have a need, I know exactly where to go. It's been a great thing. So I'll stop there. We've got some time, a good 20 minutes or so. Questions, discussion? Yes, sir.
I have two questions. The first one has to do with how do you guys appropriate those funds differently than the funds that you take in normal tithe alms? In other words, the alms, how do you determine what you're going to use that for? Is there an overriding policy about that? Or can you help differentiate that a little bit to me?
Yeah, so it's a separate fund that's administered by the deacons. So it's not part of the church budget at all. So whatever the church values that it wants to put money into, that goes in through the main church budget. So things like missionaries we support annually, or the care, you know, all the things that a church pays for. The alms fund is a separate fund, wholly administered by the deacons to do as they see fit and wise. How do they do that? That's had different iterations. And even now, the current diaconate, which has changed pretty significantly, is kind of rethinking through that, which is good. They're trying to ask questions like, say things like, we can't do everything. And one of the good problems that we've had is that I think our church has become known for this in our area. And so we get a lot of people sent to us. But it's beginning to realize, like, okay, we're not going to be able to do all these things. So what are our priorities within the kind of broader scope of our church's priorities? For example, most recently, the Alms Fund has been thinking about, well, how do we determine whether we should help a missionary or not? And one of the things they're coming to is, we're going to have to say no unless there's a very specific and like critical case that we feel is wise to help. We're going to have to say no to just to random missionaries that have been sent to us, because we want to focus on giving more to the missionaries that have gone out from our church or are going out, whether short-term or long-term. So we've got a couple of young people, one who's spending 3 months in Belize this summer, and one who's spending a year in Portugal, both with NTW. And they've said, you know, you need to go out and do your work of fundraising, but we're going to help you meet. Whatever you can't get, we're going to do. You're one of us. We're sending you out. But if a young person, you know, is an RUF intern from Alabama that comes to us, we'll talk. Our deacons will talk to them, but they're probably not going to fund. So more and more, we're trying to kind of codify what is the mission of New St. Peter's particularly, and how can the Alms Fund be primarily geared toward meeting that mission and secondarily be geared toward responding nimbly to critical needs.
Good, thank you. My second question is this. In Acts 6, one of the things that I think gets lost a lot as people teach that passage is the fact that there was a daily administration to the widows.
Yes.
Every single day. Why are we so far away from that? I don't know a single church. I know one church in Philadelphia, but I don't know too many of the 1900 PCA churches that have a daily administration to anybody.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's particularly in the United States, but in history, why did we get away from that New Testament caring so much for the poor that, like you said, they laid money down? And now we're so far away from that. Any idea where that shift has, why it's here? Why is the church not saying, yes, we need to go back to helping the people?
Yeah.
Even our congregation?
Yeah, the answer is the growth of the nation state. That's the answer. It's a relatively recent world history that the nation state, or what in our case we'd call like the government, exists in any form like it does now. It's relatively recent. And this is like the last couple centuries. Before that, if you live in a town, the place that's at the center of the town is the church, like literally the church. If you've gone to any like any city that in Europe, or any colonial city, like any colonial Spanish city, you know, in Mexico or Peru or whatever, you go to the town square, and you'll see what is a probably some kind of government building, and then you'll see like the church. And it was just known in society, not just in church society, that like if you have a need, like, well, that's where you go. There was no conception for most of world history up through the all through the medieval era, the early modern era, that you would go to the state for help. Now, the growth of the nation state, this has kind of been a two-way street, because I think what you see is both the growth of the power of government, which recognizes rightly that if you're going to have power, you should also have care, right? Like that power requires care, actually, I would say biblically. So you see that the natural outgrowth of the state is that, well, we need to do some of these things. These are our people. And you see the seeding of that by the church, right? That even Christians who and churches who say they love the poor, are like, well, why are we going to open a food bank? Like, there's already a food bank. Or why are we going to provide this? There's already, you know, this kitchen. So it's a dual thing. How can Christians change that? It's very simple. Just start doing it again. I don't think that means advocating that the state should not have any role in it. I actually think the state should have some basic role in care for the poor, but not a role that means that the church doesn't do it anymore. Yes, sir. I'll come back here.
You mentioned that your diaconate manages your alms fund.
Yes.
Is that the whole diaconate or a subset of deacons chosen to do it?
Great question. So in the last 4 or 5 years, we actually, when I was on the diaconate, we ended up changing how we did that in a particular way. So we created like subcommittees within the diaconate. And the idea was we were coming to meetings, there's like 10 of us, and all of us are having to talk about everything. And it was just like a real time suck. And we realized, wait a second, what if we have subcommittees within our diaconate that put people toward their particular interests and giftings so that we're not having to like, who wants to do it this time? And there's 10 of us. It's like, oh, is there a need for a tangible physical mercy need? That's going to be the alms and mercy committee, right? So we have three, I think now it's three guys who are the alms and mercy subcommittee. They're empowered by the diaconate to give up to a certain amount without consulting the rest of the diaconate. I can't remember the number. It's something like $750 or $1,000. It's more than what just an individual might want at any given time. And if they want more than that, they do bring it to the whole deacon board. Hey, well, there's a big need. We want to give $3,000 to help this missionary. Then the whole diaconate votes on it. But otherwise, and daily, in our diaconate, an individual deacon is authorized to give up to $100 to anybody for any reason. They just have to keep a record. The Alms and Mercy Committee can give up to whatever, $750, and then the diaconate can do whatever it wants.
So in our church, we have a subcommittee, a mercy committee. They manage the fund. They decide what to give and how much. And it's only when we give like over $3,000 we have to go to the session.
Oh, okay.
The deacons have already given us approval to go up to that.
Yeah.
It's $1,250.
Okay, there you go. In our case, we don't go to our diaconate does not need to come to the session.
Yeah, but it's where we set it up.
Yeah.
When we give, because we've given $30,000-$40,000 to people who have serious needs.
Yeah.
Okay, our church. Yeah. From the mercy fund.
Yeah, wow. Yes, sir.
It's kind of a broad question. Getting back to what you were saying about the role of the church and the state as it's developed in the modern age. Struck by the examples in Scripture, how and in Geneva, where the injunction is not to go around the economic structures. So, for instance, you said in Geneva, the physician or Wittenberg was sort of basically hired
Yeah.
To, so they're not saying the physician needs to work for free, and they're not eliminating or destroying economic structures which are valuable and necessary. And currently, evangelicals tend to be very much against interaction with the state. Mm-hmm. And mainline Protestants and Catholics have different relationships with the state and how they work. How do we adjudicate our relationship with the state in view of the realities of the structures in which we live and the abundance of help that can be available?
Yeah.
So it's a broad question.
Well, I mean, it's important, though, because, I mean, I do not think that the Bible requires, or church history requires, that we do everything separate from the state, that we somehow have to create our own parallel everything. And that, in fact, there's great value on your diaconate of knowing what the state, the city, the state, the feds, are already doing, right? So, you know, there's, for example, if your city, your neighborhood has an excellent food bank that's working really well, it actually might be better for your diaconate to say, you know what, we're not going to create a food bank. We're going to give to that one, and we're going to start going and volunteering there, right? Like, our church is going to be known as, like, the best volunteers at the food bank. That is an excellent use of resources. And you're not giving away your commitment, your theological commitments. In fact, I would say you're spreading them, right? Of course, there might be limits if you decide to work with the state. I mean, this happens for organizations all over the world who work with the federal government for with doing particular programs, you know, aid programs. Like, there are certain things that you can do and you can't do. But if you're willing to work within those bounds, you can still be who you are and take great advantage of it. There may be cases in your local context where you say, we can't work with the state here. Like, they're doing work that we actually think is counter to our mission. But I would suggest to you that most of the time, broad welfare, broad care work that the state is doing is at its baseline good work that needs to be done and would be enlivened and made better by Christians getting more involved in it, not less involved. Did that? Yeah. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, just to add that, I kind of agree learning what's out there is good. I'm just barely starting to do that in the St. Louis area. But one thing I thought I'd add, at least in our area, I discovered recently that the United Way, and that's kind of where a lot of organizations point people to the United Way as first kind of state help, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They often are telling people that are needing help short term, just call the churches, just call around all the churches, which I found very interesting. And that can kind of be overwhelming. The few churches I benchmark in our area, a lot of the resources, if they have deacons fund, they have to sort of dedicate towards their own congregation and maybe friends of the congregation, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to manage the people outside. I think there's also value in people within it, especially in an urban area like St. Louis, within those churches in a presbytery are working together in some way. I've had a couple examples where that happened by chance, and it really was gratifying and also powerful to work with others.
You might establish something like an administrative deacon who helps all the...
I picked up on that.
There is value in it. I mean, I would love for North Texas, which is my presbytery, to do something exactly like Orlando's doing. I think we're primed to do so. Yes, sir.
First of all, this is good. Thank you so much for your information and your experience. I have a lot of questions, but the one big question I have is, I think it's in When Helping Hurts that the quote I remember mostly is one-way giving is an erosion of human dignity, something like that.
Of what?
Of dignity.
Oh.
Of dignity. And it's that seems to be intangible or in conjunction with the idea that to give someone or to treat the church as a charity will send the wrong message, and that what we should really be after is moving someone from needing something to self-sustainability.
Wholeness. I think
wholeness.
He talks about being whole.
Being wholeness. Yeah. How are you thinking about that? How is your church thinking about that in terms of who we give to, we want to see them not be needing anymore. What's your process determining need, as well as how do we get them from needing from us to?
That's the core hard question, right? So a couple of things. So first of all, this has been a tension in our diaconate, and it might be in yours too. And so where I kind of fall on this is, I think that book is very valuable, and it teaches a lot about the importance of long-term sustainability and bringing wholeness to people rather than just staunching a wound. He talks about it as like stopping the bleeding.
Yeah.
The danger that I've seen in leaning into that is that we become the person with the talent who doesn't invest it.
Yeah.
Because we don't invest it because we can't or don't have a long-term strategy, and we therefore don't want to waste it. And I really believe that biblically, the thing we lean into is giving. So that's the first thing. It's like first instinct should be meet the need. That should be our inner instinct. After that, though, we talk a lot with our deacons about like that the office is more than that, that it actually is spiritual care and it's practical care. So if someone comes to us for a need, we tend to be pretty free giving, a random person, we tend to be pretty free giving on a first ask. Like, oh, I need some money. We usually don't give cash, but we're like, hey, we keep gift cards on hand, for example, to like Walmart and Target. And we're like, hey, here's $40 or $60. Like, we talk to them if we can. If they come back again, we will then often consider a second gift, but we will tell them, hey, we don't do this long term. We would love to help you, but if we're going to do that, let's sit down. Let's hear about your bills. Let's hear about your income. Let's hear about your family. Tell me about yourself. And the goal is that a continuing stream of money ministry is not going to keep happening without a more holistic ministry.
Okay.
Which involves spiritual care, practical care. So that's a very practical way to bake it in, is that among your deacons or your church, you say, we want to be free giving. We're going to have a policy where we give X amount or X number of times without anything else that's required, not of them, but just required even of us. But at a certain point, we're going to say, this is what we start doing for the purpose of not just keeping like binding up the wound, but making you whole. Sometimes that yields amazing stories of wholeness and people who join your congregation and teach you so much. And sometimes that yields, I'm out, you know?
Which is why I love the analogy of seeds being sown, because I think that kind of ties right into that. But one more time. If I call your church right now and say, I need money for food, without any questions, yeah, come by and we'll give you a gift card for $50.
That's what we do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
Okay,
our official time is up. So I want to end us here. We do have a 15-minute break officially, so I'm going to hang here in case you just want to chat more. Yes, but let me pray before we close, and then thank you all. Father, thank you so much for your care for us. You did not stay in heaven, but sent your son to come and be with us, to show us mercy. Lord, help us to have that heart in ourselves, not considering our power or our position as important, but being willing and even driven from inside to go to others in need, even at great cost to ourselves. I pray for our diaconates. Help us to care for our churches well, for our communities well. Help us to care and communicate with one another so that, especially for our denomination, we can grow in this, be a light to our country in the way that we care for the poor. Pray for the rest of today. Help us to have open ears, give other speakers wise words from your word. Amen.